the state of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law. Please be seated.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record in Klein versus Farmers Insurance Company. Matters before the court for oral argument. Farmers Insurance Company, the appellant, will be represented by Gary Cooper. On behalf of the respondent, Erica Klein, Kenneth Lyon will argue. We welcome the 8th grade class from Connor Academy from Chubbuck with other well-wishers, I see. And that's Jonah Lloyd and Joe Bowen, who are their teachers. You're welcome and pleased to have you. Are there any preliminary matters by either party?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Mr. Cooper, on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court and counsel. I'm representing Farmers Insurance Company of Idaho in this matter. We're here on a permissive appeal. This is an appeal from a denial of a motion for reconsideration on a motion for summary judgment that Farmers Insurance Company of Idaho filed in this case. The issue which Judge Cardinaroli, the district judge, felt and kind of encouraged the parties to file for a permissive appeal was one that hasn't been decided in Idaho, and that's what the issue is here before the court now. And simply stated, it is when does the statute of limitations start to run on the contractual obligation to pay underinsured motorist benefits under an insurance policy? We all agreed and still agree that the statute of limitations is 5 years. Issue is, when does that start to run? The district court decided that because the relationship between an insured and the insurer is contractual, that it can only start to run if there's a breach of contract. And then the court went on to say that because the contract itself, the policy in this case, doesn't establish a time frame within which to file or seek arbitration, that then that is a question of fact for a jury to decide whether it was made timely. By trying to force this case into a breach of contract, I think the district court made this terribly complicated, and it doesn't need to be that complicated. This isn't a breach of contract case. There's been no breach of contract that's been alleged. What the issue here is whether or not the demand for arbitration was made timely. Judge Cardinaroli, the district judge's decision, makes it terribly complicated because if the statute of limitations has not expired, as he ruled, on the demand for arbitration, why would it be a question of fact as to whether the demand was made timely? That seems to make it awfully complicated for an insured who makes a demand for arbitration of an underinsured motorist claim or an uninsured motorist claim. Both would be affected by a ruling in this case. It almost seems that the judge was establishing a latches defense, which latches was not pled as a defense in this case. And so, you know, one has to question under the district judge's decision, who has the burden of proof on this? Is it the claimant that has the burden of proof since the insurance company didn't raise an affirmative defense of latches? That's one complication.
The Mr. Cooper, could Farmers have demanded arbitration?
Yes, Farmers could have demanded arbitration.
And never did?
Never did, because there wasn't any reason to.
Well, wasn't there an acknowledgement of a disagreement between Klein and Farmers as to how much should be paid or whether the UIM coverage exceeded what they had paid?
Well, you can look at it that way, but the way I look at it is what the policy obligation on farmers and a statutory obligation on farmers was to pay the amount justly due under the policy. Farmers did that. There was absolutely no reason for them to seek arbitration of that decision.
Well, I'm going to challenge that a little bit. I mean, right on the heels of that 41-1839 demand was discussions about mediation and how do we get this claim resolved. And I recognize that that there's been no breach of contract pled, but why isn't it that the failure to meet the plaintiff's demand at the time of the 41-1839 demand is a breach of contract? Why didn't the claim start to run right then?
Well, because you would have to assume that the amount justly due was the wrong amount. That hasn't been decided yet, and it won't be decided until that matter is arbitrated. Just because we didn't pay the amount that the claimant demanded doesn't mean that that isn't the amount justly due or that it was a breach of contract. Farmers did what it was required to do under the policy, and that is pay the amount justly due.
Well, they determined what was justly due. That isn't to say that what was paid is what was justly due.
As I said, until the matter is ultimately decided in arbitration, we won't know. And the claimant in this case could have immediately demanded arbitration. Instead, they waited and waited until more than 5 years had gone by, actually 7 years.
But the way 41-1839 operates, you know, that attorney's fee valve, I mean, the moment the plaintiff says, you haven't met my demand, you owe me more money, you know, you're off to the courthouse filing a complaint for breach of contract.
I don't agree that you're off to the court to the courthouse to file a breach of contract claim. Your obligation then, as the insured, is to demand arbitration. That's exactly what happened in Walden. I don't know that there was an amount that was paid in Walden, but there was a disagreement as to whether or not the demand was appropriate, and the insurance company demanded arbitration because they didn't pay any amount, and that's what the plaintiff did in that case. So they ran off to the courthouse and filed a lawsuit, and the court dismissed the lawsuit because there wasn't a breach of contract yet, wasn't a tort case yet. And that's what we're talking about here, and we can get awfully confused if we look at this as a breach of contract. What the issue that the district court decided and what the issue here is when does the demand for arbitration have to be filed? Is it forever? No. We say it is 5 years from the date of the accident.
Why?
It doesn't make any sense to say that it has to wait until a breach of contract.
Why? I mean, is there anything in the policy that says that?
No. And I don't think that the policy could say that. If you look at the Allentown case and Idaho Code Section 29-110, the problem with that is that let me just read 29.110. Every condition in a contract which limits the time within which he may enforce his rights is void as against the public policy in Idaho. And the Sunshine Mining case versus Allendale Mutual Insurance Company, 107 Idaho 25, said that the insurance company's attempt to change the statute of limitations or the time within which to bring that case to 1 year was void against public policy. So if the insurance company tries to put this in a policy, it could limit the time within which to bring the case, and it would be void as against public policy. For example, in this case, where Judge Carnaroli decided that it was a breach of contract, let's say Farmers said, you have to file your demand for arbitration within 5 years from the date of the accident. Judge Carnaroli would say, that's wrong. It doesn't start to run until you breach the contract. So what the insurance company did was try to limit the time within which an insured could bring the case and be void as against public policy. That's the problem with insurance companies placing limits on the time to do it in view of the Allendale case and in view of 29-110. It creates a real problem. And Judge Carnarelli didn't recognize that, because when he issued his decision, the first decision, he said, why didn't the insurance company define the date when this had to be filed? My position is they couldn't, because it would have violated Idaho Code Section 29-110. That's why I think this court, or the legislature, I mean the legislature could do it because they've established the accrual date and a number of different things. But it's also a question of law for this court to decide if the legislature hasn't acted, which it hasn't in this case, so it's incumbent upon this court to decide when that cause of action accrues. And the cause of action is not for breach of contract. The cause of action is for arbitration, demanding arbitration. And I think clearly if we look at the Uniform Arbitration Act, which applies to insurance policies, the demand for arbitration in court is a very simple matter, just as the policy here describes it. It's simply a motion, and decided as a motion.
But what statute of limitation applies to the failure to demand arbitration? What statute of limitation applies to that? You're suggesting that it's a failure to demand arbitration, so what's the statute of limitation?
5 years. It's the contract statute of limitations. We all agree on that. This is an obligation. Idaho Code Section 5-6.
It's a breach of contract statute of limitations.
That's where I disagree. It's not only a breach of contract statute of limitations. It is the statute of limitations for breaches of written contracts, but it is also a statute of limitations that applies to any contract, obligation, or liability founded upon an instrument in writing. Now, I think it's important under Title V, Chapter 2, that we look at some of the other provisions that says that special proceedings can be substituted and used for an action. Special proceedings include arbitrations. Title 7 of the Idaho Code is special proceedings, and Chapter 9 is the Uniform Arbitration Code. So if you substitute arbitration, it fits. Statute of limitations is 5 years to demand arbitration. What's the accrual date? I submit we don't use breach of contract because you don't need a breach of contract to demand arbitration, so you have to pick a different date. And the logical date in underinsured or uninsured motorist claims is the motor vehicle accident. That's what the obligation is under the contract. The contract says that the insurance company will pay what the insured was entitled to recover from the underinsured or uninsured motorist.
Why is that the logical date? Why wouldn't we say that it should be the date on which the underinsured liability is known, which would be the date of the judgment or settlement in the underlying case, in the third-party action?
Well, we pose that as a possible date to use, and this case would be barred if we used that.
I understand.
The reason that I think that it isn't the best in Idaho is because we no longer have an exhaustion requirement under these underinsured cases. And so because they don't have to exhaust the underinsured benefits, because they don't have to exhaust the liability limits for the insured driver, it no longer makes sense to create that as the date. It should be the date of the accident.
Mr. Cooper, I went back and looked at Hill, and what it says, in summary, the exhaustion clause is void based on Idaho's declared public policy aimed at protecting its citizens from underinsured drivers and on the doctrine of judicial economy, which here includes shielding parties from excessive litigation and preventing unnecessary demands on the judicial system. Claimants need not exhaust the limits of the tortfeasor's policy, but instead must credit to the UIM insurer the gap between the settlement with the tortfeasor's insurer, if any, and the policy limits. And here's where I want you to focus on. Because Hill settled with the Hamiltons for just under their policy limits and is ready to credit the gap to American Family, the summary judgment in favor of American Family is vacated. I don't understand how you get from Hill to the assertion in Farmer's brief that after Hill, an uninsured can make a UIM claim immediately following an accident, but it doesn't require any kind of settlement with the tortfeasor.
It doesn't require settlement with the tortfeasor because they give credit for the amount of liability insurance on the at-fault driver. So they don't have to settle. In fact, if you read the rest of Hill, Hill says they don't even have to file suit against the at-fault driver. There is absolutely no exhaustion requirement. The insured may decide that, for example, if it's a $25,000 policy and we're talking about a catastrophic injury and somebody carries UIM limits of $500,000, why would you go to the trouble of trying to collect that $25,000? You would immediately go after the UIM coverage. That's what the elimination of the exhaustion clause allows, and insurance companies have to immediately, upon notice of an accident, start thinking about a UIM claim.
So if I'm a plaintiff and I've got that $25,000 policy, and I sue the tortfeasor with the $25,000 policy, do I then join as an indispensable party my UIM?
No. It's not necessary to join. It's not a lawsuit against the UIM carrier. However, you can immediately make a demand on the UIM carrier for what you believe are your damages and proceed with arbitration. And you can proceed with arbitration side by side with the claim against the at-fault driver. And as I said, you may just decide it's not even worth going after the $25,000 because going to court is going to be expensive. It's going to require attorneys. I mean, there's no requirement for me if I want to pursue a UIM demand that I hire a lawyer to do that. I can immediately demand arbitration.
So a catastrophic case oftentimes takes more than 5 years.
Yes.
How do I get my money then? If I've got to wait until I know what your exposure is, sue them immediately? Sue the UIM?
I don't have to sue. This case
or
is
ask
not...
for arbitration?
Yes.
Ask
yes.
for arbitration?
Yes, absolutely.
When I don't know exactly what I have recovered from the underlying insurance company?
It makes no difference what
or
you
what
recovered.
What my damages are? Or what my damages are?
Well, okay, that's a fair concern, but it's a concern that every litigant has against the at-fault driver. We require them to bring that case within 2 years, and it's quite often we don't know what the ultimate damages are. We don't know whether the person that had the injured hip is going to have a hip replacement 20 years from now. Well, there's a mechanism for that. You get a doctor to testify. They're going to have a hip replacement in 20 years, and this is what the cost is. That's done all the time. It isn't any different in the UIM case or the UM case because what you're mimicking in this insurance coverage is the same thing that you would get from the at-fault driver.
Well, it seems to me the other issue, though, that you've got if you... All right, so you can make your claim immediately upon the accident. One of the issues that we have in Idaho is we allow two different types of offsets for the UIM carrier. That is to say the policy that allows for an offset against damages and that allows an offset against the policy limits. And it seems like you might not be able to adjust. Giving credit could be very complicated in a case where, depending upon which type of policy you've got, what type of credit the insurance company is entitled to.
I'm sorry, I don't find that complicated at all. Once you know what the limits are from the other carrier, that's what you get. That's the offset. If the third party, the at-fault party, has $50,000 in coverage, and I have $250,000 in UIM, I get a credit, or the insurance company gets a credit for the 50.
Depending upon what kind of policy you have. There are other policies that don't directly offset the limits, but instead all it is it that $50,000 I get from the tortfeasor, let's say my damages are $500, that $50 will come off of the $500, so I only get $450. But so that the carrier's responsibility is still the $250,000 limits. You get into an argument with the carrier about whether they in essence get any credit for that policy that the tortfeasor has, because my damages are greater.
Okay, so let's play that scenario through. What happens in that case is that if my coverage is $250,000 and the underlying is $50, but we don't have the offset provision, all I have to do is determine what the damages are in arbitration. And if it's $300,000, I get the entire $250. I may not know in advance what it is, but I will through arbitration. That is the outlier, because most policies are an offset policy in Idaho. State Farm is the only one that has the above limit. So, well, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for clearing that up. Sir, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you. Please, the court and counsel. I want to start by talking about what this case is not. It's not a situation where Farmers wasn't aware of the accident and aware of the UIM claim. The record supports that Farmers was aware of this when the settlement with the underlying tortfeasor took place just prior to the year anniversary to the accident. This is not a situation as well where Farmers didn't have the opportunity to investigate the accident and determine its rights and obligations under the policy. And in fact, by payment of the undisputed amount of $75,000, that suggests that Farmers had ample opportunity to investigate the underlying accident, the potential defenses that it could raise with respect to liability, with respect to damages, and it came to a conclusion that the $75,000 was the amount justly due. And that amount was paid within 2 years of the accident, or just before the three-year anniversary.
Shouldn't that, in a normal case, put the plaintiff on notice that I've got to do something else?
Pardon?
Shouldn't that, at that point in time, put the plaintiff on notice that I've got to do something else? They've given me $75,000, that's all they're going to give me? And as a result, what else is the insurance company or the tortfeasor supposed to do?
Well, at that
wait around another 5 years?
Yeah, well, at that point in time, though, here's what took place in this case. There was a discussion between Ms. Klein's counsel at the time and Farmers about that $75,000 payment. And the discussion was, listen, we've received this undisputed amount. Does that constitute full and final settlement? Or is there, are you willing to keep the claim open so we can discuss this and negotiate this? And there was a discussion between counsel and Farmers that left the claim open for her future medical needs. So by all practical intent, both parties understood that the claim was still open, subject to negotiation. And that is important because under the language of the policy itself, it says that arbitration is not necessary until both parties cannot come up to an agreement with the value of the claim. And so with this intent to continue to negotiate, that complies with the policy language. Now, arbitration is only necessary when there's no longer an agreement as to that amount. So Farmers never indicated to Ms. Klein that it was no longer willing to negotiate. So there was never a reason at that point in time for Klein to file for demand.
Don't we have tons of cases where this very same thing has happened. A car wreck takes place. An attorney talks to the insurance company, or the plaintiff talks to the insurance company. Yeah, we'll pay you something. Here's something. Here's something. And then the statute of limitations runs, and they say, here's nothing. And we have time and time again said, the fact you keep this thing open for negotiations past the statute of limitations means nothing. You're out of court. So I don't understand your argument.
Well, I'm not understanding. I'm not aware of the case law that the court is referring to where somehow the open negotiations then times out the claim by a statute of limitations. In fact, that's the whole argument why we're here. There is no Idaho case that talks about...
Not UIM. It's the issue of negotiations past the statute of limitations.
Like on an underlying automobile accident?
Sure,
yeah. And so, but you're not dealing with the type of policy language that we have in this case that says, because this is a contractual issue, and there is no dispute about that this is a contractual obligation, you look to the terms of the contract as to the obligations of the parties. And that term, that contract of the policy of insurance says that both parties are to negotiate. Farmers has an obligation, in fact, to negotiate in good faith. And so both parties negotiate. When those negotiations break down, it's at that point in time that arbitration becomes necessary. So in this case, neither Farmers nor Klein signaled anything that suggested that negotiations couldn't continue with this case. In fact, it was just left open. In fact, when my office got involved with the case, that was the first question I asked Farmers. What is the status of this claim? Is it still open? Is it still subject to negotiation? And it was. In fact, Farmers talked about, well, let's go to mediation to try to get this case resolved. And we said, okay. In fact, we went and participated in mediation to try to come up with an agreement. It was only after all of those efforts failed that there was no longer an ability to get the case settled, come to an agreement as to the value of the UIM claim, that Ms. Klein then filed the demand for arbitration.
So was arbitration demanded of Farmers before the complaint was filed?
No. Well,
you indicated arbitration had taken place. Maybe
mediation.
Mediation. If I said arbitration, I misspoke. It was a mediation that took place. And that was an attempt to come to an agreement to resolve it.
No, but was there ever a demand for arbitration by Klein to Farmers?
Not until we filed. And the reason it was filed, again, goes back to the language of the policy.
I'm not sure I understand. So the complaint alleges a demand for arbitration?
It does.
Why do you have to file a complaint to demand arbitration?
Because the policy requires it. And there was some thought process.
Read to me the policy that says that arbitration must be pursued in a district court or a court of competent jurisdiction.
In the record at page 177, this is the policy in the arbitration provision. It says, formal demand for arbitration shall be filed in a court of competent jurisdiction. The court shall be located in the county and state of residence of the party making the demand. Demand may also be made by sending a certified letter to the party against whom arbitration is sought with the return received as evidence. So the policy, when I looked at it, it has these two provisions, but it has a mandatory provision that says formal demand shall be filed. There's also a legal action clause, and this is, again, similar to the Walden case, that says we may not be sued unless there is full compliance with all the terms of this policy. So out of abundance of caution, although arbitration could have been demanded, I guess, informally by way of the certified letter, I felt it was more prudent to actually file the demand for arbitration as required within the language of the policy. And so that's how the action got in front of Judge Conaroli, was that it was a formal demand. That's when Farmers came in and filed a motion for summary judgment to, essentially, we have no longer any contractual obligations under this case. We, even though it's a, we're, the parties are dealing under the contract, and even though the parties have been working within the terms and conditions of the contract, Farmers now asserts that it has no longer any contractual obligations because it wants to pull out its obligations from the contract and carry it over to the accident and have this court follow the so-called accident rule, that the statute of limitations begins to run there.
When Farmers tender $75,000 after a demand of $250,000, why isn't that a signal that the parties disagree and that Klein's obligation at that point in time is to file a demand for arbitration?
It could very well be determined that. And if so, then she was within that five-year period of time. So I think the Walden case, I would agree with the counsel, that I think the Walden case certainly suggests that if the parties are working within the policy, the language of the policy, and moving towards arbitration, then there is no breach of contract. And so, it's not like Farmers, demand was made of Farmers and they denied or refused to participate in arbitration. So we don't have that sort of breach. We don't have a situation where they just denied, refused the claim. But it could be construed at that point in time that there was a disagreement. I don't agree with that suggestion, though, based on the language of between Ms. Klein's counsel at the time and Farmers. If Farmers had said, for example, we're going to pay you the $75,000, that's all we value this claim, where you take it or leave it, at that point in time, I think it becomes a little clearer as to what Klein's obligations would have been to move forward with the arbitration process. Because at that point in time, it would have been clear that there was no agreement between Farmers and Klein as to the value of her claim. But in this case, that's not what we have. We don't have Farmers ever saying, $75,000 is all you're going to get. We're going to close the claim. In fact, it's just the opposite. They gave the intention to continue with the negotiation. And essentially it sat around for a couple of years until my office got involved, reopened those negotiations, attempt to reach a resolution. We were unable to. Once we got to that stage, that's when arbitration was filed.
Did they ever pay anything more than the $75,000?
No. Not at this point in time, and that would be subject to the arbitration provision. So I think the date of accident rule really is in conflict with Idaho law, particularly the Walden case. You've got a situation where, take for example, say Farmers did come in upon payment of that $75,000, and just because they don't agree to pay more, Walden suggests that's not a breach of contract. But say Farmers came in and said, okay, we're only going to pay you $75,000 and we're done. We're not going to go arbitrate. We're not going to do anything. Well, that failure, that refusal to participate in arbitration would be a breach of the contract, which would start the five-year clock running under Walden and a whole plethora of Idaho case law. That would be in conflict, though, with this accident rule that proposed by Farmers, that the statute of limitations starts to run at the time of the accident. Essentially, Farmers could breach the contract and shorten the time period for the statute of limitations for a breach of contract, because technically it started to run at the time of the accident. So that puts in conflict a whole host of Idaho case law that just doesn't apply or would not apply or would have to be modified or potentially even overruled if the court were inclined to go and follow the date of accident rule. You know, the date of accident rule really is something that started, in based on jurisprudence in other states. And it's based off the idea that the insurance company gets to step into the shoes of the tortfeasor at the time. And the Sullivan case in Idaho specifically rejects that concept. So it would also, put at question really the fundamental jurisprudence in Idaho as the relationship between an insured and the insurance company. And so for that reason, the date of accident rule, I think, actually would complicate things more than following just the normal breach of contract rule. There's nothing about this case that is complicated because there is no breach of contract. Farmer seems to suggest that because there's no breach of contract, this is something unusual. I don't look at it that way at all. This case follows the terms and conditions of the contract. The language itself seems to be fairly clear. Both parties understood that they need to come to an agreement on the value of the case. If not, then the case proceeds into arbitration. There was the intent by both parties to negotiate and try to reach a resolution with the value of the claim. When that failed, then arbitration was filed. The fact that there's been no breach of contract really doesn't mean anything other than now we're in arbitration and we'll proceed forward. If you go with the other complication that would come up with not only the date of accident rule, but the settlement rule, is it would allow, because there's no breach of contract with the case, if you're following those earlier time frames, it really conflicts if, in fact, there is a breach of contract later on. And so I think that the breach of contract rule makes the most sense even under these circumstances. Judge Conaroli did look at the case and say, okay, well, there is no formal provision, there is no time frame in which to make a demand, and he imposed the Weinstein conditions about whether that should be a reasonable time frame or not to be determined by a jury.
One of the problems with the breach of contract rule, though, the uncertainty about whether and when the contract has been breached. Under the scenarios we've been discussing, I'm not sure it's always clear at what moment and on what day there is using your theory, if we went with that, how do we determine exactly what day that occurred and whether, just because there's a disagreement doesn't mean that there's a breach. So how do we determine that?
Well, I think when you have the arbitration provision, I do think and the Walden decision, I think the Walden decision does complicate things because it suggests, going back to Justice Brody's question, okay, well, if Farmers, pay the $75 and Klein doesn't agree with that, isn't that a breach of the contract? There are a lot of other jurisdictions that would find that disagreement, that is the time when there is an implied breach at that point in time.
So at the time the $75 was paid and the parties basically agreed, we'll keep discussing this, there was a breach on that day?
No. Because of the arbitration provision, then I think the only way that the policy could be breached is by Farmers coming in and saying, we're going to refuse to participate in arbitration.
Well, and that can only happen when the complaint is filed. So isn't it kind of a self-fulfilling problem? The statute of limitation would take effect when the complaint was filed?
No.
That seems to make no sense at all.
No, they certainly could, like when they paid the $75,000, they could have certainly said at that point in time, we're not going to participate in arbitration, and the clock starts running.
And I understand that. That was the first question I asked you. So the $75 was paid, there was an agreement, we'll discuss this later. Now, if they had paid the $75 and said, drop dead, we're not going to pay you anything more, I think that would be pretty clear. But that's not what happened here. They said, we're going to pay you the $75, maybe we'll talk about it. Now, you're saying that it only kicks in when a request for arbitration is made. Under this contract, a request for arbitration can only be made by filing a complaint, which then would lead to the result that the statute of limitations starts the day you file a complaint, which doesn't really sound like a statute of limitations to me.
Well, and that may be the effect, that may be the effective result. I mean, Farmers is the one who wrote this policy. We're working within that policy. Now,
Does that make sense, though, as we just look at policy in general as a court, that we allow the parties to start the statute of limitation on the same day they file the complaint, therefore the statute of limitations would never be able to be raised as a defense?
Well, I think it has to go to what the claim is about, though. I mean, if you look at the date of the accident, here's another way of looking at it. You have the accident. What could Klein have done at that point in time? Could she have filed a breach of contract action against Farmers? No.
But Mr. Cooper says submit a 41-18-39 demand, and they have to adjudicate your, process your claim right then and there. Boom. You don't wait. Nothing. You get your money.
And I completely agree with that, because the claim process is different than litigation. You can file a claim with the insurance company. Doesn't mean you have to go in and file a lawsuit.
Right.
And so you can file a claim right out of the gate, but can you file a lawsuit? Well, if you file a lawsuit, what would that lawsuit look like? Would you file a lawsuit for breach of contract? No. There's been no term or provision that's been breached at that point in time. Could you file for arbitration? No, not under the terms of this policy, because that requires a disagreement between the two parties, which implies some sort of demand at least be made to Farmers to take a look at and either accept or reject it. If they reject it, then at that point in time, there's a disagreement as to what would take place. Either party then has the right to file for the demand.
I agree this makes sense when we're dealing with hypothetical facts and facts maybe we can remember from our practices and things, but I'm trying to apply the facts of this case to the question of law, a unique approach maybe. But as we look at this case and these facts, what you're arguing to this court today is that if we apply the date of the breach rule, that there was no statute of limitations. That's the inescapable conclusion of these facts in this case.
That there has been no breach up to this point, correct? And the lawsuit was, in fact, the lawsuit does not allege any sort of breach of contract. It is simply a demand for arbitration pursuant to the terms of the policy. So, by all practical purposes, because of the specific language that we're dealing with, because of the factual, the facts on how we got to this point, that is the reality. There has been no breach of contract.
So what you're telling us is that there is actually nothing for this court to do in this case other than say that the date of accident starting the statute of limitations does not apply. But we cannot set another formal rule for any other case.
And that very well could be, yes, because there is no... no allegation of some sort of breach of contract. Farmers is trying to avoid its contractual obligations by saying the clock. We're saying the clock hasn't even started ticking yet. Farmers saying no, the clock started ticking at the time of the accident. That's the dispute in front of this court. And however the court feels it most appropriate to resolve that dispute, which I think is just. If it says the date of accident rule is not law in Idaho, then that would be sufficient to be able to go forward and allow us to proceed into arbitration.
What are other alternatives to an exhaustion clause that insurers have available to them that actually trigger some kind of obligation to pay? And what I'm really getting at is, are we potentially setting up a system that's maybe inconsistent with what other policies, how other policies operate?
Well, generally there's going to be a claim filed with the insurance company prior to any sort of litigation. And most policies say that that claim has to be done in a prompt and timely manner. Going back to my initial discussion, the reason you file the claim initially is to put the insurance company on notice of the accident so they can come in and determine, you know, whether there's liability issues, what the damages are. They can investigate and determine their rights and obligations under the policy. And so he'll, you know, all Hill does is say that can be done immediately at the time of the accident. You don't have to wait to exhaust all potential remedies against the tortfeasor before the insurance company has that obligation or the insured has that obligation. So that's the first step. And then after that, the terms of the policy dictate what the rights and obligations of the parties are. This policy that we're dealing with says that, you know, the parties have an obligation to work with each other to try to reach an agreement as to the value of the UIN claim. If that doesn't happen, then arbitration is the next step. This policy is then more particular when it says it gives you two options. You can file with you shall file with the district court, or you can file an informal arbitration with by doing a letter. I think there's a conflict within that policy. That's not before this court. That's not, you know, something we need to resolve because we did file the lawsuit. You know, it puts at issue the Yochicher case out of Wisconsin that's cited in our brief. That was a situation where a similar arbitration provision that we have here, where Farmers went in, and it was against Farmers, the parties went in to arbitration. And the arbitration proceeding was going along, and then Farmer said, we're going to withdraw from the arbitration process, which then prompted a lawsuit for the breach of contract. And at that point in time, because they were saying that the clock has run out, the statute of limitations started at the time of the accident, even though they were in arbitration. There wasn't a formal arbitration. There wasn't any lawsuit that had been filed. It was just an informal arbitration. They're in arbitration, and then they withdraw from arbitration, forcing the lawsuit for breach of contract. The court in that case found that they were still within the statute of limitations, but if the court were to adopt a date of accident rule, and the reason the court found it was still timely is because that's what they went off this settlement judgment rule. They didn't go all the way back to the date of the accident. And so, but if the court had followed the date of accident rule, technically, the claim would have been exhausted by the statute of limitations, even though they were in arbitration at the time. And those are the types of things that I think make this type of decision that you really create more confusion if the breach of contract rule is not followed. Given the nature of Idaho case law, statutory law, and the way this court has always maintained that insurance policies should be interpreted, the breach of contract rule is the rule that Idaho should follow under these circumstances. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll finish my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does the appellant have?
10 minutes.
Sir?
Thank you. I think it's important to understand that the issue is not whether the proof of claim in this case was timely, because that was done within 3 years, 2 years and a few months. The issue is, how long does one have after that to demand arbitration? And it just, it makes no sense to me that it would require a breach of contract, because if everybody goes silent after that proof of loss is made and a timely response is made to the demand, it could be forever. Never comes to a close. And that's what we're struggling with here is what's the accrual date? What starts that to run? And because we're not talking about breach of contract, we shouldn't be talking about breach of contract as being the trigger. We need to look at a different trigger. And the logical trigger seems to be the date of the accident.
But if there's no breach of contract, how do we get involved?
I don't know that it would be necessary to become involved.
Wouldn't there be justiciability and rightness issues if a complaint was immediately filed following the accident?
Well, it depends on what's asked, because that was the problem in Walden, that they immediately filed a breach of contract case and a tort case. Well, nothing had happened to trigger a breach of contract or a bad faith case. That's why it was dismissed. The issue was arbitration, which is our issue here. You can demand arbitration either under the provisions of the policy, which is what Ms. Klein did in this case, or under Title VII, Chapter 9, the Uniform Arbitration Code. It tells you exactly what you have to do. It's not file a lawsuit. I mean, we all think of that as a lawsuit because you're filing something in court. It's a special proceeding. You're simply making a motion to compel arbitration. If there's a disagreement as to whether there's a agreement on arbitration, that gets resolved on that motion. So, for example, let's just say that on the day after the accident, that they came in under Title VII, Chapter 9, Uniform Arbitration Code, they made that motion to compel arbitration, and the insurance company said, well, wait, nobody's even made a demand here. Well, fine, you've got plenty of time. There's a provision in the Uniform Arbitration Code for staying the proceedings. You simply let them make the demand and respond to the demand. I mean, maybe they come to agreement and the whole case is done.
See, I'm again trying to get my head around this case in these facts. The hypothetical scenarios actually make more sense than this case does to me. In this case, I think I heard opposing counsel say, well, there really wasn't a breach of contract. We had to file this to start things. And yet, is there even now a breach of contract until your client says, we're not going to pay it? And in this case, right now, you're just saying, well, we don't think we should have to arbitrate it because too much time has gone by. So has there been a breach of contract, in your view, alleged that's taken place in this case even now?
No, there's no allegation that there's a breach of contract.
So it makes little sense to me that we're spending so much time talking about a breach of contract measure when we really don't have a contract that's been breached in this case.
I agree. That's where everything went off the rails when the district court said you have to have a breach of contract to start the statute of limitations running for a demand for arbitration.
But Farmers wants us to decide when that arbitration demand had to be made.
Yes. Well, I think all of us want that decision, including the district court said, you know, this hasn't been decided yet, and it's pretty much determinative here, because if you choose two of the three choices, Ms. Klein's out.
Well, it's pretty clear most of the states agree with the breach of contract theory currently. Do you agree? That's the majority rule?
Well, not a majority of the states. A majority of the states that have decided
this. It's the plurality rule. Would that be a better way to say
that'd
it?
That'd be a better way to put it, correct.
So assuming that we go along with the plurality of our sister jurisdictions then, if you were to look at the facts of this case, and you and opposing counsel know exactly what happened in the negotiations far better than we can probably tell from the record right now, when do you believe that you refused to pay more than $75,000? And if there is a date that you can designate as that, would that not be perhaps the day that would make more sense to measure this by?
I think I'm following. So the date that the farmers said that they're not going to pay more than $75,000 is December whatever of 2012. You know, they offered on that date to settle the case for that. And when the question was put to them, are you saying that you want a release for this. Farmer said, no, we recognize that this isn't the end to it, and expected at that time that there would be more information, and it never came. But I don't think that that's the date, because that doesn't solve the issue of the person that never even opens the door. There still has to be a date by which you have to demand arbitration. And the logical date to run it is the date of the accident.
I'm just concerned whether the facts in this case properly tee us up procedurally to make the decision you're both asking us to make. If we were asked to issue an advisory opinion, I think that would be an easy decision to make. But do the facts in this case allow us to make the decision that you want us to decide here today?
I think so. Because we have a clear date of accident. We have a clear date when the arbitration was demanded. And that's all you need.
Which was the date the complaint was filed.
Okay. There's actually a date earlier than that, but it's only a few days prior to that, or a month. I mean, they sent a letter, and I didn't stand on procedure, and I accepted it as a demand for arbitration, said, here's the arbitrator we choose.
But as opposing counsel correctly indicated, there is a second way to demand arbitration, and that is through a certified letter. Was there a certified letter sent in this case?
No, and that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
They sent a letter, and I said, fine, let's just accept it as a demand for arbitration. I mean, it's our decision. We can accept that as a demand for arbitration at that
point. You waived the certification request.
We did, exactly. But they wrote back and said, whoa, that wasn't a demand for arbitration. We're going to file a lawsuit to demand arbitration. So, fine, they did.
How can it be the date of the accident when the policy doesn't allow for a demand for arbitration until there's a disagreement as to the amount that's owed?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that I think is worthy of consideration. But, like any other case, you might do something immediately to stop the statute of limitations for running, and that is to either demand arbitration by the certified letter or to file the demand for arbitration in court, even though you haven't complied with the obligation to make a demand for the policy limits or whatever amount you feel is owed. But as I said, the Uniform Arbitration Act takes care of that. It provides for staying the arbitration if those things haven't taken place. And so during that stay, you take care of that.
But you think it's reasonable to file, for example, a special proceeding that we've been talking about when you know, when you read the policy and you realize there is no factual basis upon which I can actually make this demand?
Well, I don't think that you can say that there isn't any factual basis. You've been in an accident. You've incurred damages. You may not have sent off the letter yet, but I'd do anything to stop the statute of limitations from running. I mean, I've had people come into my office the day before the statute runs, and maybe I don't know much about the case, but I've filed a lawsuit to stop the statute from running. That's what we're talking about here. If everybody knows, right now, nobody knows when it starts. And so, what are you going to do? That's all we're asking for is some clarity here. And
should we be concerned about what the terms of other policies, other insurers? I mean, us reaching in and determining how things accrue for this particular policy is one thing, but coming up with a blanket rule for, you know, that's I'm worried about, are we going to somehow be in conflict with other insurance policies out there that have been approved here in Idaho?
Okay. That's a good point, but I think 29.110 takes care of that. If the policies are actually trying to set up a time within which to demand arbitration, a time within which to sue the insurance company, those are void in Idaho. So the insurance companies can't do it. If they did try to do it, it's void anyway. It's incumbent upon this court to establish the accrual date.
But doesn't 29.110 prohibit the shortening of the length of time? It doesn't affect the accrual of the length of time, or the accrual of the action, does it?
Well, in my mind it does, So as I tried to say earlier, if we went in and said, if Judge Carnarola's rule, if you decide to support him and you say it's breach of contract, and I come in by policy and say, forget about that being the accrual date. The accrual date's the date of the accident. Didn't I just shorten the time within which to bring the action? I think I did. And 29.110 would trump it. It's void as against public policy. That's the problem with the rationale here, that it was our fault for not putting it in the contract, because it goes back to that Allendale case that said you can't do that. I remember I used to practice in those days before Allendale. Policies did have that language in them. Said you have to bring an action on this policy within a year or 2 years, things like that. Those all disappeared after that decision because they're not enforceable.
You got the light blinking.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Matters under advisement, we'll render a decision.
She's here.